From the Firebird Radio Studio, it's the Authors on Fire podcast with nationally syndicated radio host and producer, Pat Rulo.
Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network, home of the Firebird Book Awards, the Positive Change Podcast Awards Hall of Fame, our newest book song, where we create a unique, one-of-a-kind song just for your book. And home to this podcast, Authors on Fire, I am Pat Rulo, and today's guest is author Chaz Holdsworth, a Philadelphia native whose writing is shaped by poverty, trauma, and the contradictions of growing up with a heroin-addicted father and a mother devoted to fundamentalist Christianity. After 25 years of writing, he has now distilled these experiences into an unflinching collection of poems on love, loneliness, depression, faith, politics, and society's fault lines. Through his Life and How to Live It memoir series and his poetry collection, When the Light is Mine, Chaz brings raw honesty, dark humor, and a powerful sense of resilience to the page. Today's conversation is going to be about survival, self-discovery, and what it really means to find your voice when the world has tried to silence it. Chaz, welcome to the Authors on Fire podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Thank you for being here. Oh my gosh, that's quite a bio here. So we've got quite a bit to cover. Let's just start by giving our listeners a quick sense of who you are today and perhaps how far removed you are from the world we meet in your books.
Well, I'm very far away from where I came up at. I grew up in the Kensington section of Philadelphia that's known for crime and drug abuse and poverty. I live now in the suburbs with my wife, and I always say that the joke is I took the long way to adulthood, and that's why I'm so far away from where I came from. Who I am now, like I said, I have a wife who I love. I'm a full-time mail carrier for the post office. I'm really engaged with social justice groups and political. I'm the committee person for the Democratic Party in my neighborhood, my district. I'm also the shop steward, the union representative for my office. These are the things that are important to me that I gained as I went through life, realizing that there are things that need to be done in the world that is neglected, like workers' rights and people that are just having wealth inequality issues. So that's pretty much who I am now.
Wow. Don't you love a journey, huh?
Yeah, it's a journey.
So when people hear your story for the first time, what do you most want them to understand about that version of you?
I'm a work in progress. I also say that the books, which I'm planning on doing 7 of them in the series, is almost like a case study of a human being that was born into absolute nothing and how they were thrown into the world to make it on their own and how they survived and how they had to figure out their own moral compass and figure out how to have a life where you can feel safe and be prosperous. So that's pretty much that story. The first story is called Begin to Begin, and it's the start of my life, of course. And it's something that shows you where I came from, and it's in a way like I'm not playing victim here, and I'm not looking for pity, but it's more of like, this is what happened to me. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. This is the world I was born into, and I had to make some kind of sense of it. I wasn't going to settle for the things that were handed to me, which was absolute poverty and my mother's born again Christian faith that was so overwhelming that we weren't allowed to be part of the secular world. Anything that was not born again Christian was ruled out for the most part. Mm. So like they cut off family members because they were Catholic or Protestant and not born again. It was a cult. I mean, it wasn't a cult like the other, you know, what the definition of cult is, but it was, they cut us off from the world. Even though they cut us off from the secular world where it came to things like music and movies. But I also saw the world of poverty and crime, and they didn't protect me from that. So that's pretty much where I want people to read that this is where I came into, and then how I started to develop my own identity and questioning of everything. And then all it comes down to, when I was 13 years old, I heard by chance a song by the band REM called Losing My Religion, and it struck a chord in me. And I wasn't allowed to listen to music. I didn't have a radio. Rock and roll was the devil's music. The Christians were very strong on that issue. But I was actually on vacation with a family friend that was from the church in the middle of nowhere, Pennsylvania. And we're at a rec room where there was a jukebox. And this older teenager put on Losing My Religion. And I was scared at first by the sounds and the title. But then as the summer went along, I would hear the song here and there, like in stores or in my cousin's mom's car while we're driving. And eventually I heard it enough where I was like, I like this song, and it opened up something to me. And then once that door opened up, I was a music fan, and I came into music at a great time because it was like the rise. It was like 91, 92, and there was so much great music coming out. Nirvana, Pearl Jam, U2, Tori Amos, and Radiohead. And I just had I fell in love with it so much. And it was, so the whole series of Life and How to Live It is all coming from, it's all based on REM songs. There's an REM song called Life and How to Live It. And in the lyric, Michael Stipe says, if I write a book, it will be called Life and How to Live It. Mm-hmm. So I took them literally. And then every subtitle is going to be an REM song. So the first one was Begin to Begin because it's the beginning. Second one's called Near Wild Heaven because it's the beginning of my wild teenage years where I'm thrusted into the world without God and without the church. And I start making it on my own. My friends are my real family, the girls I meet that I loved. And I started to, you know, go down a road of trying my own drugs, especially LSD, and starting bands and going to see shows. And it's just it's also just a story of how I'm still trying to figure it all out.
Mm-hmm. A lot of times when things in childhood are forbidden, they become extremely attractive, and which is great when you're talking about music. It's a different story when you're talking about drugs. I love that music became a lifeline for you. Why do you think artists could reach you in a way that people in your life couldn't?
Well, my immediate family, it was a mess. Like, my father was a heroin addict, like I said, and at first, when I was really young, he was trying to put up the fight of my mom became a born again Christian because of my dad's addiction in 1982 when I was four. They were already married for 10 years. He was a heroin addict when she married him, but my mother also came from poverty and she had really low self esteem and thought she could change him, and she loved him so. She had my sister with them, and then 4 years later, she had me. I always joke around with her now. I'm like, you knew he was a drug addict. You knew how hard it was when you had my sister. Why would you have me?
What are you doing?
But she...
I'm glad she did, Chaz. I'm glad she did.
So she was a very meek person. So she really wasn't strong. And her way to guide me was what guided her and gave her comfort now, the born again religion. And everything about that is just Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. And my father, after 1985, I guess, he just kind of gave up on the battle, trying to keep me grounded away from the born again religion. He thought my mom was in a cult. He thought she was ridiculous. But he was Catholic, and he was trying to keep me into, like, make me go to Catholic church once a week or once a month and see both sides of religion. But his addiction just took over, and he would be out most weekends. We wouldn't see him. So I didn't really have that. And then the Christians themselves, the ones around me, some of them were good people, but the authority figures were very strict and judging, and they also just didn't give me good advice. If my dad was a heroin addict, instead of trying to get him help for his addiction, it was, he's not saved. He's going to go to hell. He's got to be saved. That's how you got to save him. And we were in such poverty. Like we didn't have hot water for 5 years once. We had roaches all over the place, and we had rats once, we had mice, we had drug dealers sitting on our corner. It was just bad every day. And the Christians just kept telling me, you got to pray. Oh, it's God testing you. And it's things that weren't, I'm not asking them to save us from it physically, but eventually I was like, this isn't true. I don't believe this. I would pray and pray and pray, and nothing would change. And then, so nobody around me was positive. It was like I saw through everything. So once I realized what was going on, and I was old enough to realize that I was in utter poverty, my education system was horrible because we didn't really have teachers. After my fourth grade year in the born again schools, they went from a teacher, a person teaching kids like they usually do, like talking out loud, to a homeschooled program that was, we're still in a school. There's like about 100 of us from kindergarten to 12th grade. We had like cubicles face the wall, and we would read these things called life packs that were like every subject had five, had 10 books a year for these things. And you get their magazine size, and you get to fill them out and then take the test on the end. And we didn't have like, I learned algebra and science from these, and you really didn't know anything. If you didn't understand something, there was no teacher to ask. And so we were all left with no education. And when I was 13, 14 is when I realized this, and I realized my state in the world. And that's when music just felt, the music of the time was just saying the things how I felt. Like it was Nirvana, Nine Inch Nails, REM, Tori Amos. It was just great music coming out. How I felt isolated and full of doubts, and feeling my self-worth was nothing. And it just really grabbed me at the time. So it's a lifelong, I just, it's my, in my DNA now.
Sure, no, I
I
get
mean,
that. It helped you. I mean, it was your guide when there was no one else. It sort of sounds like you've come to understand your mom's motives. I mean, they were radical and extreme. Is there forgiveness now? How was that relationship?
The relationship very superficial. It's on the surface. There's a lot of like, she's the kind of person who doesn't want to talk about the past. She even back then, she would cry. I had to comfort her because my dad's actions, but she never, it was always pray, God, God, God's gonna be better. It's like constant thinking that God's in control, the absolution. So there really was no relationship besides that, besides us fighting over religion when I got older. But now she is better now than she was like 10 years ago. Like I said, right in a book, my mom has, she didn't wear pants for 40 years because the Christians say that pants are, they show off the body of the woman. You can't do that. So she didn't wear pants from 82 to like 2023, and she only read them, she only started wearing them when she read my book. She was like, oh, I'm like, yeah, it's weird, mom. Just wear pants.
Well,
Right.
if anything good came out of your book, your mom's wearing
My
pants.
mom's wearing pants on break right now. And she'll call me once in a while and be like, I bought pants today. I'm like, that's great, mom.
I love it. Oh my gosh, life is
Right.
just so bizarre. So we've got two volumes out. The first one, volume one, kind of describes your childhood. The second, your identity and your faith. And so now what, number three is in the works?
Three is being edited now. Three is pretty much the same as the second. I just had to cut them down because of I don't want them to be too big. But the second one, so both the next, so after I leave the church, that's the end of the first one. The next two are all about just me running around like a maniac. I say it's like my Jack Kerouac kind of style book, but instead of going on a road, I just stay in Philadelphia. I'm just I meet some good people. I have some interesting stories, but then I meet some bad people. I meet some crazy people, and I just talk about all that, and then girl, a lot of the relationships I made with the girls in my life, and still trying to figure out the big picture. Like I'm always looking for something. I wrote my first book. I have a title called "I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For" from the U2 song, and that's basically what it, I'm. I left this born again religion, entered this big secular scary world, and I'm looking for something. And that's what I'm still doing in this last volume and the next volume. I'm looking for something.
Okay.
So everyone's going to be where I think I end them, where it's almost like a cliffhanger, but also where I think something significant happened in my life. And as I go further into the other volumes, I enter parts where it's the worst times of my life, where I'm just an anxious mess with nothing, with I'm all my dreams didn't come true, all the girlfriends that I love, they're gone now, and I'm just I'm in survival mode, where every day I wake up and I feel like I'm in a bad acid trip, and somehow I survived that. That's probably gonna be the fourth one or fifth one.
Okay. So then we have your poetry book, When the Light Is Mine. How is writing poetry different than writing these memoirs? What can you say in one that you can't say in the other? Or how does that feel the same or different to you?
So I've been writing poetry for 30 years, more than that. I mean, when I first started writing it, I was, you know, I lost all those ones. My teenage years, I lost them. But I just would write just to get it out. Like, I just had this urge to write something. And mostly what influenced me isn't poetry, really, but more of the lyrics of all my favorite artists. My favorite parts of a song are the voice and the lyrics. So I you know, the lyrics of Tori Amos, Michael Stipe, are a lot of streams of consciousness, and you have to kind of dig deeper to figure out what they are. And that's what influenced me in these years, my coming of age years. And I developed this desire to write like that. So first I wrote poetry that was really probably generic and I think bad, but then I started to get this style of where I just opened my mind up and let it come out. And it's something where I feel like it was also some of the darkest times of my life. Music was there for me, but also going on a pen and paper or a computer or now my cell phone, if I want to type real quick, it's like a place where I can just let thoughts come out of me. And it's almost like I try to, it's my way where I try to center myself and see the big picture of everything. And I just let it flow out of me. And so people think it's streams of consciousness, but I think most of it, I think, is relatable or it makes sense to people. Some of it you have to think, like, it might be only personally to me. Some of it might be you dig a little deeper and go, oh, I know what he's saying here. There's a certain rhythm to it. Maybe I'm writing a song in my head that I never made. But so I talk about everything from my organized religion, the religion, a lot of talking about my doubts with God and the religion I was born into, a lot about my self-worth, my self-loathing, a lot of depression, a lot of how I see society, politics, social justice things. And then the last section, I broke them up into four sections. The last section is my love poems that I wrote over the years for girls that I were infatuated with that liked me back, some didn't like me back, and of course some about my wife. Mm-hmm. So that's what I and it's just easier to flow. It just flows out of me. There's no boundaries. I can just, you know, if I think it's a clever line, I'm keeping it in there. Where the memoirs is like I'm trying to tell you exactly what happened. And I put my personality in there and my dark sense of humor or my little bit of wit, but I also am just saying, hey, this is what happened.
Right. Yes, in your poetry book, there is a thread of hope that emerges by the end of the collections. Mm-hmm. So I imagine that writing your books and your poetry books, it's changed your relationship with the past because you can confront it and look at it.
Yeah, that was first it was hard. Like when I started writing this, I write about this in the beginning of the first book. I started writing because my only sister passed away in hospice from cancer at 45 years old. She was diagnosed in February and died in June, and she was living in Maine and I was in Pennsylvania, and I had keep making these trips to go see her, take my mom up there. And then I got the call that the end was near, so I rushed up there. And 5 minutes later, she passed away in front of me in hospice. And her eye, like when she opened, so I watched her gagging for breath, which was something that was very shocking to my core. And then she died, and her eyes kind of focused on me, and it made me remember my sister from my youth. My sister was growing up was very angry and mad about our situation. She was more angry than I was, and she was a bitch. And she was really mean to me, but I still idolized her. But then we had a falling out in our teen years, and then I went my way, and she ended up marrying the only eligible guy in our church because that's all she could do, because the Christians set her up for failure with an education system. So she married the only guy and became like a Stepford wife, kind of. Like she just totally went from being my sister who had her own mind and was angry to this polite woman who kept everything hidden down and tried to be the housewife type. And then when she died, she was looking at me, and it was almost like her resting bitch face on me. I'm like, that's my sister.
Oh.
So then all around me were all the born again Christians, because I was by myself, because I wanted to Maine, and I wanted to bring my wife to this. So I that they were all trying to use this to bring me back to the fold. Like my brother-in-law was like, my sister loves you, you got to come to heaven with us. There was preachers there that were part of their church in Maine, and they were trying to be, hey, you want to pray about this, and like they're trying to use my grief, and I just for to get them back, get me back to the Christian their Christian faith, and it just made me upset. So I went out that night in this town called Rockland, Maine, where they lived at, and I went to a bar and I started drinking and met these two girls. The one girl owned the place with her father, and I started talking to them about this and that, and then it's a good conversation. Then they faced what I was doing here, and I said, "Oh, my sister just passed away." And they were like, "What?" And I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "Well, why are you with your family?" I'm like, "Let me tell you some stories." So I started telling them about my life, and then the tears started coming out. I was kind of holding everything in, and when I left that bar, I looked down and I looked at myself and saw my feet as I was drunkenly walking back to my hotel, and thought to myself, I still haven't found what I'm looking for, and decided I had to do something. And I made a deal with myself to write this story. So I started writing, no idea what I was going to do with it. And then COVID hit. So then I was an essential worker. So I had to work every day. So all I did was work and write. I had no other outlets like concerts or baseball games or bars or friends out. So it was dark. Like I went down, I thought about things, and I had to, it's not just about thinking things. I had to like remember the details and write it down. And like it was hard. And my poor wife had to deal with it. But eventually, once I published the first one, I did feel better. Like I do. Like now that I'm almost done. I'm done pretty much all the bad stuff. Now the next books aren't so bad, so I do feel better with my past, things that haunted me, the demons that haunted me for decades don't have much power anymore because I confronted them, and I'm hoping that not just confront them, I'm just hoping to do something with them, even if it's just put them out there so people will be entertained by them or find some kind of hope in them. That's what makes me feel better about the life that I live, that I'm doing something with it.
Right. And your readers may not have experienced anything exact as you had, but you can still extrapolate those feelings of fear and loneliness and being afraid and all of that. So you have no idea who you're going to impact and how. And so just the fact that you were able to write these books, not only to confront your fears or to have like a cathartic moment for yourself, just think of what you're giving the world.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. This is a blessing that you are able to put this out on paper and put it out there. I appreciate that. Wow. There's so much more we can talk about, but I guess your books are going to give us the real peek into what's going on. So is there anything we missed before we begin to wrap up? Anything we missed that you wanted to highlight?
The stories are, they're like a coming of age story, the first few ones, but they're also like pop culture time mm-hmm. capsule. Like it's a lot of like people that grew up in the times will get a kick out of the things that I mentioned. I say it's almost like I'm Forrest Gump too. Like I'm running through the world and absorbing all the things around me as I talk about it. So I talk about what was popular here, what was going on here in history. And so I think people will get a kick out of that too. And then also, like I said, it's not like what was me, let's feel bad for me. It's more of I write these stories in an entertaining way right. where I laugh at myself. And I also have one of my taglines is, let my suffering be your entertainment. Like, just laugh along with me.
Oh, you're a good one. How about then places folks can go to find you, more about you, and get copies of your books?
Okay, my website is chazholsworthbooks.com. From there, they can find me, find the books on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Ingram Sparks. They can see in the blog area the reviews I've gotten so far from places like Kirkus and Book Life. And my Instagram is Chaz Holsworth Author. And then on Facebook is Stories by Chaz Holsworth.
All righty. All right. So the website, chazholsworthbooks.com. You can find his memoir series, Life and How to Live It, and the poetry collection, When the Light is Mine, wherever books are sold, as he just mentioned, his website. Chaz, thank you for your honesty, your courage, and for sharing your story with us today. It's so, so meaningful. And I just so appreciate you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.